This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is Jim Dwyer, card number 521, outfielder, first baseman for the Baltimore Orioles.
And we will get to that Orioles magic in just a moment. But before we get to Jim, David, you had a note here about magical Lithuanians.
Well, we're going to talk about Orioles magic today, but Matt, you witnessed actual, real magic. I recently saw on Twitter, twitter.com is a popular website used by doofuses and nice people alike, but I saw one of the doofuses was up in arms about some magic that's occurring in our neighborhood. There's apparently Satanists and magical Lithuanians operating out of a magical lounge that is not far from us. I'm disappointed that I was not informed by my Lithuanian newsletter. Arvydas Sabonis didn't text me about this, that there's Lithuanian magic happening in the neighborhood, or that there's Satanists. So, Matt, are you okay? Do we need any of our spiritual advisors to the 1988 Tops podcast to intervene?
Not at all. No, this week I had a chance to visit the Chicago Magic Lounge in my neighborhood and had a chance to see the stage show of Paige Thompson. Her website is pagesmagic.com, which we'll have in the show notes, as well as the link to the Chicago Magic Lounge. It's a very fun time. Really encourage people to come up to the north side and check it out because it has three different venues inside. Paige Thompson stood out, though, because her set was baseball themed and, in fact, involved baseball cards. Did not have 1988 Topps cards, sadly, but did have the 1989 Upper Deck cards. Paige did a trick that was a throwback to a trick by Matt Schuline, who is an innovator and founder of Chicago-style magic in the 1940s. David, if I were to say that there's a Chicago style of magic, what would you guess it might be?
Does it have celery salt on it?
It does not have celery salt. It does not have way too much cheese or ingredients that are in the wrong order. Instead,
is it corrupt?
No, it's not even corrupt. Chicago style magic, it's like dinner table side magic. So close-up magic, you know, people doing card tricks right in front of you, or tricks with coins and things like that.
I went to a continental-style dinner place in Quebec City where a man cooked a steak right next to my table.
Yes.
Is that's Chicago-style?
Chicago-style, yes, correct. So doing tricks by your table is essentially what they did. And in Paige's set, she did this trick where she has someone pick a card. And in the old days, what Matt Schuline would do is he'd put the card back in the deck, he would throw the deck against the wall, and the chosen card would be tacked to the wall by a thumbtack, mysteriously. Well, Paige Thompson did this exact same trick, but instead of using a deck of playing cards, because she said, I hate doing card tricks, she said, but I love baseball cards and love baseball. So she had a person pick a random card out of a stack of 1989 Upper Deck cards, which I immediately noticed and recognized by sight when she was flipping through them. And the participant chose Bobby Ojeda. She put it back in the deck, threw it against a baseball dartboard, so the dartboard that has the baseball bases on it, which the participant held up, and right in the center, in the bullseye, stuck the Bob Ojeda, stuck by a thumbtack. It was a very cool trick. She also later made a Toronto Blue Jays hat appear out of a box magically, which the participant was from Toronto, and so the crowd was really mystified. So go see Paige Thompson if you like baseball-themed magic, and it was really a good time, so highly recommend.
It is very amusing to me that this Paige Thompson is 100% the person who on this doofus on Twitter was saying was worshiping a pentagram. You went to the show and she's actually talking about baseball cards and the Toronto Blue Jays. Don't trust the internet.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, don't trust Twitter. She is purple-haired. I don't think that she was worshiping Satan.
The real trick would be if she made that piece of Bob Ojeda's finger come back. Bob Ojeda famously had a gardening accident where he lost a piece of his finger, but I think it was reattached. So that's real medical magic.
We will get to that in a later episode. But next, we need to go across the Pacific Ocean to Taiwan, where we have a mascot update that you've put into the queue.
I don't know how this came across my timeline. Probably Andrew, maybe it was Andrew from At Painted Cap. There's a Yam Man, Chairman Yam. Chairman Yam is the mascot of Family Mart in Taiwan. One of their top-selling products is the roasted sweet potato. So on May 6th and 7th, today, they're having a theme night. So if you can get there, by the time this comes out, I don't think you're going to be able to make it. You can get to Family Mart theme night where Chairman Yam, the mascot of Family Mart's top-selling product, the roasted sweet potato, will be throwing out the first pitch. The advertisement for this that came out a couple weeks ago had an org chart with Chairman Yam. Chairman Yam, yesterday, I just found myself saying Chairman Yam and laughing. I don't know why it's so fun to say. Chairman Yam is clearly at the top of this. His second in command is a yam wearing a baseball hat. And then all of the players are his subordinates. All of them in this picture are eating roasted yams. Mm. I need to try this because it does just look like people are walking around Taiwan eating roasted yams out of a little paper holder, just taking bites out of a yam. But Chairman Yam got to throw out the first pitch, and he, in this org chart, is wearing a suit with a tie. But when he showed up for the baseball game, he is naked.
Reminding me very much of Mark Chardy and his Chippendales outfit, where he was really just wearing a bow tie and a smile. Here, Chairman Yam, he's got a collar and a mustache pasted onto his potato body. He did throw a very good pitch, though, and he looks very excited and proud of his work. He threw a Yam Ephus ball in this pitch. It was an excellent toss. It's a strike. That's in there for a strike.
Good mascot technology happening in the CPBL.
Yeah, we're always looking for great mascots here. I think Chairman Yam shows very good potential for our 2023 mascot power rankings. We're always looking for hard-hitting mascots who are rising the ranks. This chairman knows what he's doing. He's got this entire organization in line, all of them eating the sweet potato products as they should, really breaking new ground when it comes to tuber-related mascots.
It's a little bit concerning, though, as he is the chairman. Are they eating his family? And is he next?
I'm sure they are distant relatives, very distant relatives, if related at all. If you have any mascots out there that you see that you would like us to review, please email them to us. You can send any tuber-related correspondence to 1988topspodcast@gmail.com. And now let's go to this week's card and Jim Dwyer. And why are we talking about Jim today?
We have not had many Orioles episodes. We've only had 4 Orioles cards. And one of those episodes was 2 cards in one episode. So really only 3 Orioles cards. We have talked about Orioles magic because we do get to guys who played for the Orioles like Len Sicada. But we haven't had a Orioles-specific card since Floyd Rayford 50 episodes ago.
Oh, man.
Jim Dwyer is a Chicagoan, shares an alma mater with a past guest, family of the show. He had a great nickname, Pigpen. He was a longtime role player and played for the Orioles 1983 championship team. He was always a good hitter, but his card is kind of emblematic of 1987. The rabbit ball year provided Jim his best power season. He hit 15 home runs. And if you look at the back of this card, a ton of lines, never a double-digit home run total until 37-year-old Jim Dwyer hit 15 home runs. Jim has a Sabre bio, so thank you to Tom Mank for your work on that. And thank you to Jim Dwyer for our episode this week.
Sounds great. Let's go to the front of 521. And here we have not the best look and layout for a card for Jim Dwyer. He's looking askance. His hair is looking askance. His mustache is kind of spotty, looking up at his face. And so you can kind of see up his nose. They didn't do him any favors today. The hat is also very big and pulled down very low over his brow.
I could see why Pigpen just seems a little bit disheveled. He's got a furrowed brow, There's just a lot going on and none of it seems in order.
Yeah.
His hair, his mustache, his eyebrows. Everything seems a little bit out of place.
Is that like that collar built into the uniform, or is he wearing an undershirt under there? It's kind of also an odd collar situation.
I thought at first that this might be a painted-on shirt, but there's no reason why it would have been, because Jim was with the Orioles since 1981, so they should have had a picture of him in an Orioles uniform. I think it's just a weird draped-over look.
Yeah, you also see palm trees in the background and clearly a spring training outfield wall because there's some advertisements or other kind of markings on it. You can also see the power lines, so it has the feel of Florida.
I don't know what this face says about Jim. Is he scared, surprised, concerned?
Let's go to the back of 521 where we have Jim Dwyer, outfielder, first base, height 5'10", 185, left-handed batter and thrower. Drafted by the Cardinals in the second round of 1971. Born January 3rd, 1950 in Evergreen Park, Illinois, with a home in Tinley Park, Illinois.
I have no notes about Tinley Park in here, but I've seen a lot of shows in Tinley Park back
in the day.
What's
the best show you've seen at the... What was it called? And how many...
I went to Warped Tour in 1997 in Tinley Park. My mom grew up not far from there. And I also went to Rockstock, and I think I saw Megadeth at Rockstock in 1997, along with some other metal bands.
Tinley Park, home to the kind of amphitheater that every major metro has, and that has changes hands and changes names every 4 years to become part of a different corporate conglomerate. You know,
I could not even remember what it was called. As I just said, Tinley Park. I went to Tinley, like, because it's had 17 names since 1997. But he grew up in Evergreen Park, located in the south suburbs, town of 20,000 people, about 10,000 when Jim was born in 1950. And the mayor of Evergreen Park is a friend of mine. Representative Kelly Burke is both a state representative as well as the mayor of Evergreen Park. And this is the first of a few friends of the pod who are mayors that we'll get to along the way. Maybe we'll have a mayor on. Get to know the town of a player's birth. Other famous Evergreen Parkers, comedian and host of BattleBots, and a person I'm not sure is related to Jim, Bill Dwyer, co-host of Singled Out and peddler of fake science, Jenny McCarthy, comedian and actress Jane Lynch, pitcher, White Sox radio announcer Ed Farmer, Unabomber Ted Kaczynski went to Evergreen Park High School, pitcher who was heavily featured in the last Comiskey documentary, The Pope, Don Paul, and NHL legend Chris Chelios and U.S. men's national team goalkeeper Brad Guzan. All pretty good list of Evergreen Park natives for a pretty small suburban town. Jim's dad owned a bar called Dwyer's Tap on the south side of Chicago. I looked and could not find the exact location of this. Jim and his two brothers would help clean up after the bar closed at 2 a.m. Because he was a bar owner on the south side of Chicago, Jim's dad was a Sox fan. But Jim was a Cubs fan because there was always Cubs baseball on TV during the day. Jim had an uncle named Don who played a season in the Pirates minor league system. He played pretty well, hitting .293, but he retired and came back to Chicago where he became a softball legend. He is in the USA Softball of Illinois Hall of Fame. I don't know what organization, how organized this is, but there's a lot of people on that list.
Where is the USA Softball of Illinois? I guess they needed their own Hall of Fame because they made a bigger ball. Again, in the Chicago-style legend, even the softball is different.
Again, it has celery salt and sport peppers. I don't know. But there are like hundreds of names on this list. I don't think there's a physical location where you can see all of the... But it doesn't look like anyone has been inducted since 2016. I'm not sure if you can find Don Dwyer's softball jersey somewhere.
Chicago-style softball is in our hearts. It's in the 16-inch circumference-sized hole in our hearts. I love that Chicago-style softball is just softball for people who can't afford to have mitts. We don't have mitts. Okay, well, let's make the ball bigger so that it doesn't hurt when you catch it.
Jim went to St. Lawrence High School in Burbank, which is a neighboring suburb of Evergreen Park. He was an accomplished baseball and basketball player, and he graduated in 1968. At that time, it appeared he was going to be drafted into the military to go off to Vietnam, but Southern Illinois University offered him a baseball scholarship, and he accepted that to avoid the draft. SIU has a good baseball history. We discussed one famous SIU outfielder in a previous episode. That's Dave Steeb, who went on to pitch rather than play the outfield. The mascot of SIU is a Saluki, and I think this often comes up when SIU makes the NCAA tournament in basketball. What is a Saluki? A Saluki is a fast hunting dog from the Middle East. They can reach speeds over 40 miles per hour. The area in Southern Illinois where SIU Carbondale is located is known as Little Egypt, and it is where the Ohio and Mississippi rivers converge. When settlers came there, they felt that it was similar to the Nile River Delta. So some towns in the area have Egyptian or classical sounding names. So you have Cairo, spelled like the Egyptian city, but definitely not pronounced like Cairo. It is Cairo. And Thebes. And the Saluki was the royal dog of Egypt and thus was chosen in the 1950s as the new mascot. Prior to that, SIU Carbondale was simply known as the Maroons. At the time that Jim went to SIU, like many colleges in the United States, there were a lot of disturbances, protests, and unrest at SIU. And so there's an article about how in 1970, SIU Carbondale's campus was shut down due to riots. And this came shortly after the deaths at Kent State University. Prior to that, you had a couple buildings that were bombed or set on fire, a lot of protests, a lot of radical activity happening there. And this was the context in which Jim was going to SIU Carbondale. And of course, he went there to avoid the draft because it gave him an opportunity to not get drafted, but rather play baseball at a pretty established college baseball program.
So Jim becomes a Saluki. He played a bit as a freshman, getting a few at-bats. During the summer, he played for the Springfield Caps in the Central Illinois Collegiate League. And this is a team that played at Robin Roberts Stadium, named for the Hall of Fame pitcher and Springfield native. The current team there is the Springfield Lucky Horseshoes, and the horseshoes carry a special significance.
They have a couple different hats. One has a smiling horseshoe, a shoe for a horse. But Springfield also has a local delicacy called the horseshoe. And on their other hat, Matt, if you could pull this up on the Jumbotron.
Yeah, I'm pulling this up on the Jumbotron right now. You have what I recognize right away as a horseshoe. It is a food item that just has a bunch of everything. You've got a slice of bread at the bottom. You have some kind of meat patty. Then French fries, cheesy goop, and then kind of a flag sticking out of the top of it with the letter S.
They made it to look like the state capital, but it's also a horseshoe. The horseshoe, it has bread at the bottom of it. So I guess it's a sandwich.
Well, there's only one slice of bread, so maybe it's an open-faced sandwich. Horseshoes, are they good or nah?
I think it's all right. You got a good cheese sauce. It has a specific kind of cheese sauce. It is pretty good, but you're going to need to take a day off after having a horseshoe. I like to get a horseshoe with maybe a buffalo chicken at the base, but you could also get it with a burger or a different kind of meat or non-meat item. It's pretty good, but the current team there is the Springfield Lucky Horseshoes. They used to be called the Sliders back when I lived in Springfield, but they got a rebrand.
In 1970, SIU's baseball team got a rebrand as well, getting a new head coach, Richard Itchy Jones. Named that because when he broke his leg in third grade and the cast he had to wear caused severe itching, Richard stuck a fly swatter handle between the cast and his leg, and his cousin Albert nicknamed him Itchy. And the nickname stuck, although later it was shortened to just Itch.
Itchy Jones. I had to look into this because SIU plays at Itchy Jones Stadium, and I thought, that's got to be a mistake. But Itchy would lead SIU to 7 Missouri Valley Conference titles, 10 NCAA tournaments, 3 College World Series. He then coached at U of I for 15 years. We maybe have talked about Itchy Jones on the Dave Steeb episode because I mean, why wouldn't we have talked about Itchy Jones if we saw that name?
So Jim, now being coached by Itchy Jones at SIU in 1970, and had a great sophomore season, hitting .381, 7 homers, 5 triples, 14 doubles, and a 1.140 OPS. The Salukis did not make it to the College World Series that year. They lost in the regional final 8-5 to Ohio University, a team led by Mike Schmidt. That year was also the year of the Vietnam protests and riots and the campus being closed down in May of 1970. And in 1971, SIU had 3 other future major leaguers that joined the team along with Jim.
Dwayne Kuiper, Mike Eden, and Dan Thomas were all on this team. Jim was the team MVP. He hit .413 with 12 triples. The guy on the front of this card does not look like a speedster, but Jim had a lot of triples throughout his minor league career. He also had a 1.138 OPS, earning All-American honors. He led the Salukis to a 43-9 record. They made it all the way to the final of the College World Series. Jim made the all-tournament team. In that final, they played USC, and that USC team had Steve Busby, who would be a Major League All-Star, as well as Freddie Lynn. Unfortunately, they lost to USC in the championship game. In 3 years at SIU, Jim set school records for hits, doubles, and triples, and that got him noticed, and he was selected in the 11th round by the St. Louis Cardinals.
In the minor leagues, he hit for a good average, not a lot of power, but lots of triples. At Cedar Rapids, he hit .313 with 6 triples and 2 homers, moved up to single-A ball at Modesto in 1972, hitting .325 with 13 triples and 21 steals in 92 games. That got him a call up to Double-A Arkansas, where he hit .253 in 44 games and had 2 home runs that season, both of them grand slams. He also got married that year to a woman named Carol, who he had met at SIU. In 1973, he started at Triple-A Tulsa, but was way too good for Triple-A. In 87 games, he had a .387 average, 8 triples, 22 doubles, and got his call up in June.
Unfortunately, there's some inconsistent lines on this card. There's a lot of lines on this card. The first one, he hit only .193 in 57 at-bats in that short call-up to the Cardinals. After he got sent back to AAA, he finished up the season with that .387 average, which won him the batting title. So a lot of times he's bouncing up to the big leagues, then back down to AAA. 1974, he makes the Cardinals out of spring training, but then gets sent back down, having only had 5 at-bats. This Cardinals team had Lou Brock, Bake McBride, and Reggie Smith in the outfield. Not a lot of room for Jim Dwyer. But he goes back to Tulsa, hits .336. Manager Red Shandine praised Dwyer for, quote, keeping his mouth shut and working hard all the time. That's important.
Nothing that managers appreciate more than workers who just do what they're told and keep their mouth shut.
On the year, he hit .279 in 74 games at the big league level. 50 of his 100 plate appearances were as a pinch hitter. He hit his first 2 major league home runs in that stint. But 1975 was a replay. Start slow at St. Louis, get sent to Tulsa, tear it up. In this case, he's hitting .404, but St. Louis doesn't have a spot for him. So instead of calling him up, they traded him to Montreal. He played well, hitting .286 in 60 games. He was the National League Player of the Week for the week ending August 3rd, 1975, where he had a slash line of .478, .480, .826.
In 1976, he had a rough year. His playing time was limited in Montreal. He was hitting under .200 for the Expos and got traded to the Mets. His average didn't improve there, and he was sent to AAA. Over the winter, he hit .438 in the Dominican League and got traded again. This one, a 3-way trade.
The Mets got Sheldon Mallory, and the Cubs sent Pete LeCocq to the Kansas City Royals while Dwyer went to his childhood favorite. We love to talk about game shows here. Ralph Pierre Pete LeCocq Jr. was the son of Peter Marshall, the host of Hollywood Squares from 1966 to 1981. And famously, Pete LeCocq hit a grand slam in Bob Gibson's final inning in the majors. And then 15 years later, in an old-timers game, Bob Gibson threw at Pete LeCocq and said, I've been waiting to do that for years.
Oh, I love it. So this trade sent him to the Cubs, but I don't see the Cubs listed anywhere on the card.
It's a really strange one. And We get into some rules that I did not know existed. And partially it's because they only existed for a few years at the infancy of free agency. So Dwyer goes to Wichita and plays great. He hits .332, 18 home runs, so power surge, 12 triples, 38 doubles, 1.041 OPS. He's called up to Chicago in September, and this Cubs team is mediocre. Like, why didn't they have a guy hitting .330 at AAA playing for their team? He gets called up and doesn't play. The new free agency rules allow Jim to become eligible for free agency after the season. So the Cubs GM calls him in and says if he wants to play for the Cubs, he has to sign a new contract. And Jim says, no, I'm about to become a free agent and test the market. And so the Cubs released him. The union leader, Marvin Miller, said of this situation, Dwyer was falsely told he was getting a chance to play in the majors. The Cubs never let him take the field. They put him on waivers, signifying a verdict that he didn't measure up without even giving him a chance. Miller called this one of the most egregious instances of a player being held hostage by a team at the infancy of free agency. So he gets released. Must have been heartbreaking for him to play so well and not get to play for his favorite team. But he signs for the Cardinals, who remembered him as a pretty good player. He ended up with a pretty good painted cap as well because he got a baseball card, but they didn't have a chance to take his picture in spring training.
This 1977 painted cap looks incredible. He really didn't play great, though, when he joined the Cardinals in 1977 and 1978, and so was traded in 1978 to the Giants. The Sporting News said, call it the saga of Jimmy Dwyer. Will he eventually make it at least fairly big in the major leagues, or is he destined to be remembered as just another blazing AAA hitter, like a Ted Savage or even a Steve Bilko?
I just looked at Jim's AAA stats for his career. He spent 6 years in his career in AAA. He had a .353 average over 302 games. With the Giants, he didn't really catch on. He hit .225 in 76 games. And at this point, he had played for four teams, five if you include the Cubs, over six seasons. The Red Sox end up purchasing his contract, and he became a favorite of Don Zimmer and got himself a new nickname. Peter Gammons wrote, who may be the next cult hero in Boston? James Edward Pigpen Dwyer. The media have nicknamed him Pigpen because his hat's pulled down over his ears, his pants pulled down to his hips, and he's always dirty from diving somewhere. His first American League hit was a pinch-hit game-winning single. What's not to like about Jim Dwyer?
Don Zimmer liked Jim's versatility. He could play first base or the outfield. He was a good left-handed pinch hitter. And that first year, he hit .265 in 113 at-bats. And then in 1980, he started fast, hitting over .400 well into May. There was a possibility of a work stoppage in 1980, and a reporter asked Jim if he would play semi-pro under an assumed name. Jim said, I'd use Jim Dwyer. Nobody would know who I was.
He was this anonymous, unassuming bench player, and Jim got some pretty good playing time in Boston, sometimes filling in for Dwight Evans, who was having a rough first half of the season. Jim finished the season with a career-high 260 at-bats. He hit .285 with nine home runs, 114 OPS plus. Another one of these odd rules, after 1980, there was something called the Free Agent Reentry Draft. This was only in effect from 1976 to 1981, and it limited the number of teams that could compete for free agents. Teams would select players that they wanted to bid on. Up to 13 teams could select a player to bid on. So this limited teams from picking up all of the best free agents, and it limited the ability of players to negotiate with every team to get the best deal. Mm-hmm. And so 12 teams picked Jim. He was in demand as a free agent. He liked that Baltimore under Earl Weaver gave everybody on the roster a chance to play, and he wanted to play for a winner. At this point, he played for teams in the National League, the American League, and he just wanted to win something.
And he chose well. He began an 8-year run with the Orioles. He hit .224 in the strike-shortened 1981, then broke out in 1982, hitting .304 with a 147 OPS plus and 148 at-bats. He had two pinch-hit home runs, and the Orioles won 94 games, challenging the Brewers all the way to the last day of the season. Dwyer was a big part of that team, hitting .385 with a 500 on base percentage in the last month of the season, a stretch of 13 straight at bats where he made it on base, which is three short of the major league record. And in the final decisive game against Don Sutton in Milwaukee, Dwyer went 1-for-3 and walked, but the Orioles lost 10-2 and the Brewers go on to the World Series. This Orioles team, though, in 1983,
something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen, the magic of Orioles baseball. When the game is close and the O's are hot, there's a thundering roar from 34 to give it all they've got. And you never know who's gonna hear the call. Every game has a different start. That's the magic of Orioles baseball.
Orioles magic, feel it happen. Orioles magic, feel it happen. O-R-I-O-L-E-S. Magic, 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 magic.
But for Jim, he wasn't even guaranteed a spot on the team in spring training. The last spot came down to Jim and Terry Crowley, both of whom were left-handed pinch hitters. Jim had hit over 300 in 1982, while Terry was on the downside of his career, a couple years older than Jim. The two were really good friends. Crowley played well in spring training, so Dwyer was both surprised and a little bit sad to make the team over his good friend. The Orioles' choice proved correct. Crowley went to Montreal for his final season of his career, and he hit under 200. And Jim got to be a part of that Orioles magic, appeared in 100 games, had another very productive season, hitting .286 with 17 doubles, 8 homers, and 38 RBIs. Particularly in July, Jim was fantastic, leading the team with a .474 average and a 1.053 slugging percentage. In games that he played, the Orioles went 11-4.
And the Orioles won 98 games that season, winning the AL East by 6 games. To face the White Sox in the ALCS, Jim's dad congratulated his son, but told him he'd be rooting for the Sox.
I get it.
Yeah. Jim appeared in 2 games in the ALCS. First as a pinch hitter in game 1, that was a loss. He lined out. And in game 3, he started and went 1-for-3 with a double and a walk. He also scored a run in an 11-1 win. The Orioles won game 4 to set up a World Series against the Phillies. And that takes us to game 1.
Where he wants to. That's it high in the air to right field and very deep, but into the wind, and still it goes out of here.
See what I mean?
Baltimore leads it by a score of 1-0 on a home run by the role player, Jim Dwyer, against the pitcher who this season allowed 1 every 27 innings.
And that's exactly what Reggie Jackson meant in the pregame show when he said, players you've never heard of, as you look at that stroke again, solidly hit, no question about it. And Reggie said, journeyman ball players become heroes with this team.
Despite that home run, the Orioles lose the game 2-1. The Orioles win the next 2 games, but Dwyer didn't feature in either game. He started game 4, hitting a single and a double, scoring the first and the fifth runs of a 5-4 win. And that win put the Orioles up 3-1. They would win the World Series the next night. Jim's dad rooted for the Orioles, attending all 5 games. Thanks a lot, Dad.
The next few years after that high of the 1983 World Series, Jim hit around .250, provided a decent bat off the bench. He missed some time in 1984 with torn knee cartilage. And in 1985, he hit 7 home runs, 8 in 1986. In 86, he tied an Orioles record with 3 pinch hit homers. He also helped set an MLB record when he hit a grand slam against the Rangers on August 6th. In that game, Larry Sheets hit a slam for the Orioles. Toby Hara hit one for the Rangers. And this is the first time that two teams combined for 3 grand slams in a game. That record has since been tied. Dwyer's bat got sent to Cooperstown.
Big accomplishment. 1987, Jim was about to turn 37, And according to the Washington Post, Dwyer does not rock boats. When the Orioles wanted to cut his salary from $400,000 to $275,000 last winter, he hesitated about 6 seconds and agreed.
At 37 years old, Jim couldn't have anticipated that he'd stick around for another few years, but he's just a professional hitter, and he would go on to have a great season, hitting .274. That's a .131 OPS plus. He had 8 home runs in May alone. This team wasn't very good, but they had some interesting power numbers thanks to the rabbit ball. You have Jim Dwyer with 15 home runs. Larry Sheets hit 30 homers. Some really strange numbers. This is the first time in Jim's career that he hit double digits. He also only had 33 RBIs despite that power surge. That's the 6th fewest RBIs for a player with 15 plus homers.
He also hit a walk-off home run against Dennis Eckersley. This was Jim's 9th pitch hit home run, which was a record for the Orioles, closing out that 1987 season in style. But when it came to 1988, there was no style at all for the O's. They started the season 0-21. Jim was hitting .226 through August and was traded to Minnesota for a player to be named later.
He was much better for the Twins, hit .293 in 20 games, .163 OPS plus. He returned to Minnesota in 1989, hit .316 in 88 games, but that team wasn't going anywhere, so they traded him to the Expos. He went 3-for-10 for the Expos, and after the season was sent back to the Twins, 1990 would be his final season. He was hitting only .190 when the Twins released him shortly after his 40th birthday.
So closing the book on Jim Dwyer, 18 seasons in the major leagues, 1,328 games, batting average of .260 with 77 home runs, 115 doubles, 17 triples, and an OPS plus of .107. He also had one World Series win. His 103 pinch hits are tied for 17th place all time. And in the love to face Mike Smithson, hit .478 with a 1.520 OPS and 3 home runs in 25 plate appearances against Mike Smithson. Holy cow. And then Dave Steeb, his fellow Saluki, in 40 plate appearances, he hit .303 with an OPS of .926. Who did he hate to face?
He went 0-for-12 against Gene Garber, 0-for-10 against Mark Gubisa, and 1-for-21 against Tom Seaver. But that one hit was in his final at-bat in a game in 1985. He's 0-for-3 going into this at-bat. At that point, he was 0-for-19 against Seaver, and he knew it. And he said, no matter what, I'm swinging at the first pitch, and he hit a home run. So in his career, 1-for-21, but that one was very memorable.
How about in retirement?
Jim and his wife had 4 kids. Right after retirement, he played in the Senior Professional Baseball Association for the Sun City Rays. In 22 games, he hit .319 with 1 home run and 12 RBIs before the league folded. Jim's been a minor league manager and coach, including for teams like the Kenosha Twins, the Fort Wayne Wizards, the Hardware City Rock Cats, which may or may not be real. I need to look into that. And he was the Twins minor league hitting coordinator from 1997 to 2005. Then from 2006 to 2016, he was on the coaching staff of the Fort Myers Miracle in the Florida State League. And he is currently retired and living in Fort Myers.
All right, so Jim Dwyer, when we looked at the front of the card, we saw why he was kind of named Pigpen, looked kind of disheveled. But now that we've looked at him a little bit more, what do we think?
That was a real team. The Hardware City Rockcats is a real team, allegedly. All right. Jim Dwyer was the 255th pick in the 1971 draft. A guy who went to college partially to avoid the military draft. And we have maybe a sliding door situation here of what might have happened had that opportunity not been given to Jim. And Jim was just a professional hitter. Not necessarily the most ridiculous talent, but a guy who just came to the stadium, did his job, as so many managers said, did what he was asked to do, and came to work every day. In 18 seasons, he never made more than 300 plate appearances in a single season. And he played until 1990, until he was 40 years old. Bill James had him listed as the 4th greatest bench player of all time. And those are guys who are basically designated to the bench, and they know what their role is. They don't expect that they're going to be getting 162 games in a season. But Jim just had amazing longevity, a solid left-handed hitter off the bench for a ton of teams. He hit 291 in high leverage situations for his career, so he's really good in those pivotal moments when a hit can change the trajectory of a game or end the game in a lot of cases for Jim. And so for 18 years, Jim came to the stadium, won a title, and he hit 353 at AAA. This is that guy who's could have been just a quad A player, but instead made his mark on a major league team for a really long time and kept doing it well beyond his sell-by date.
I love that a guy that was not seen as an amazing prospect was in such high demand as a free agent that 12 different teams wanted to go after him when he was on the market. And that consistent value as a clutch hitter made for a great career. So a good card and a great story. So thank you, David, for that. And thank you to you at home. If you like your podcasts piled high and covered in cheese sauce, you know where to find us. We're on Twitter at Topps1988. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.